cannot see much, so, you know. Anyway, I just want to be also thanks to the speakers that will be talking this evening. So the title of the session tonight is Understanding the Numbers from HIV Surveillance to HIV National and Global HIV Burden Estimates. As you have been hearing the last few days in the conference, everybody was talking about how many people are infected in the countries, in the regions, global level, what is then the trends of new infections, the trends in mortality. And of course, the other big number that people want to hear is about what is the coverage for the scale-up of ART and how many people are on need of ART. They were talking about almost 10 million people. So in this session, in the next 2 hours, maybe less if there is not many questions, we will try to answer some of the issues. And many people don't understand how these numbers are developed and how they are made estimates in a national, regional or global level. So without further introduction, I want to introduce Sir Paolo Marcucci, who is my co-chair from UNAIDS, and then I will give the floor to Basia Saba. She is a professor of another school of hygiene and tropical medicine. She is working in Tanzania in the cohort study. She's also the principal investigator for the Alpha Network of the cohort studies in Africa. Used for the session that we're going to be run is will be a presentation around 15 minutes. It will have 1, 2, 3 questions for clarifications for each speaker, and after that we'll have a general discussion so the people are still here. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Chema. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. The presentation that I will make today is on behalf of the Alpha Network for the analysis of longitudinal population-based HIV data in Africa. This network is a forum for collaboration on data analysis, linking 6 African HIV cohort studies. We organise workshops in which one site leads with an analysis on a particular topic that is reproduced using the other site's data. We then pool our data in a common format for meta-analysis and comparative studies. We have tackled 4 topics to date: incidence trends and patterns, family demography, survival post-infection, and sexual behaviour measurement, and are currently preparing a workshop on ART access and uptake. My presentation today builds on analyses done in our 3rd workshop on survival post-infection that was led by the Masaka cohort study from southern Uganda. The 3rd Alpha workshop was much more adventurous than the others because, thanks to some extra funding from UNAIDS, we were able to invite participants from 5 cohort studies that are not members of the Alpha Network. These are the ones that are listed on the right. Since our topic was survival post-infection, we did not need to confine ourselves on this occasion to community-based cohort studies, and our guests included occupational and clinic-based cohorts and extended our geographical coverage to Asia and Central America. There's one thing I should remember. I shouldn't be calling the site from South Africa Hlabisa. It's something like Unkanyade, but I can't pronounce it, so forgive me if I refer to it as Hlabisa. In case anyone is wondering why we have a presentation on survival post-infection and a session on estimating number of people infected, we need estimates of survival, or equivalently, estimates of mortality in infected persons, to derive HIV incidence estimates from our measurement of HIV prevalence. You can think of the relationship in terms of numbers, in which case change in the number of people living with HIV is the difference between new infections and deaths of infected persons. Or you can think of it in terms of rates and proportions, in which case the proportion of people infected, the prevalence, is approximately the same as the incidence rate times the duration of infection. I stress the word approximate because the relationships are affected by population growth and other changes. And of course, the models that are used for estimates and projections take account of this complexity. The data for these survival and mortality estimates come from 11 studies, which between them have identified 4,700 seroconverters, some of whom have been followed since the late 80s, right up to the time that antiretroviral therapy was introduced in each community, which was between 1999 in Thailand and 2005 in Tanzania. The study sites use very different protocols for recruitment and follow-up, and two alpha sites only contributed data to the mortality study rather than the survival study because they had not accumulated enough follow-up time. These are the first two sites that are listed here. The data requirements for this study are actually very modest. In the case of the alpha member sites, we simply reused the data that were pooled for the incidence study that we started 1 year earlier. Most of the evidence I will show comes from the meta-analysis that was done on the pooled data set by Jim Todd from the Masaka site in Uganda, in which we restricted the eligible seroconverters to those with an interval of under 2 years between last negative and first positive test. And in these cases, we took the estimated date of seroconversion halfway between the two dates. In some references, however, to results from individual sites, I will include seroconverters with longer intervals, in which case we accept the site's own definition of estimates of seroconversion date. The pooled analysis is based on a total of nearly 20,000 person years of observation, in which nearly 4,000 seroconverters were followed in 9 of the studies, with a maximum follow-up time of 16 years. A total of 1,080 deaths were observed in seroconverters in this time, excluding the 17 genocide deaths which occurred in the Rwanda cohort, which were treated as censoring events. This graph shows the survival patterns, the Kaplan-Meier curves, observed in each study. Even from this first look at the data, a difference emerges between the African sites and those from Thailand and Haiti, which have shorter survival, that is, higher mortality. Log-rank non-parametric statistical tests show that this difference is highly significant. This table shows detailed statistics describing the survival patterns in each site. The African, non-African differences between the first quartile survival, shown in this first column here, are not statistically significant. But median survival times, where these can be measured directly, are significantly higher in the African studies. Looking at the life table proportions surviving at 2, 5, and 7 years, we can see that the differences emerge somewhere between 5 and 7 years post-infections, the differences between the African and non-African studies. In Kisesa and Rakai, median survival could not be observed, as more than half the seroconverters were still alive at the maximum follow-up time, which was 10 years in Kisesa and 11 years in Rakai. It is worth noting that confidence intervals at the end of each of the life tables are fairly wide due to the small numbers left in observation. Confining our attention to the East African studies, that is the two studies from Uganda, the study from Tanzania, and the clinical-based study from Rwanda, we can see that age at infection is a very important determinant of survival, statistically highly significant. It remains a significant predictor in the South African miners cohort, though slightly less strong than in the community-based cohorts of East Africa, but it is not significant in the Thai blood donor and partner cohort study. We repeated the life table analysis, grouping the studies geographically and adjusting for age to see whether the differences were explained by the age structure at seroconversion. But the age differences in survival were even wider after this adjustment. We compared survival for men and women in those studies that contained members of both sexes, but found no significant differences, either in the East African studies or in the Thai blood donor and partner study. This was slightly surprising, since our incidence study showed that women were infected 5 years earlier than men on average. They do appear to have a very, very slight advantage, but this is not statistically significant, with a p-value of 0.12 in the log rank test. We also investigated whether background mortality from causes other than HIV might explain the observed survival difference between African and other study sites, although intuitively they run the wrong way if we believe that non-AIDS mortality in East Africa is higher than in Thailand. For this analysis, we could only use data from those studies which also followed uninfected individuals over a comparative time span, starting from the same age distribution as seroconverters. The sites included in this analysis were the three East African community studies, the Maniland study from Zimbabwe, the South African miners cohort, and the Thai military. The graph shows that mortality differences amongst the uninfected were relatively small. By constructing net mortality life tables using the methodology that was flashed up earlier on, shown here by the dashed lines, East African and South African survival patterns remain virtually undistinguishable, but the Thai survival is clearly much worse. To proceed with regression analysis and to extend the observed survival curves to longer time periods, we examined the shape of the hazard distributions to check the fit of the Weibull model, which has been widely used to represent survival post-infection in developed countries. We found a good fit in most studies, but some exhibited a slight downturn in mortality hazards at longer duration. Kisesa, which is shown here, is an extreme example of this, suggesting that frailty effects may become important. The regression analysis confirms the significance of the regional differences and shows that sex is actually marginally significant if we do not adjust for age. A breakdown by calendar year of infection suggested that mortality had become worse over time in the South African miners cohort, even after adjusting for age at infection. We investigated the effects of seroconversion interval to see whether including those with a long interval between last negative and first positive test might introduce bias, because we would miss early deaths in this group. Indeed, the direction of the hazard ratio suggests this might be the case, although it does not reach significant proportions. Weibull curves fitted to the African net mortality schedules suggest that 25% of Africans might survive about 17 years or more, even without treatment. But in Thailand, we would only expect about 25% survival to under 9 years post-infection. These curves are now being used for projections by UNAIDS. Finally, just a very quick look at the age-specific mortality data for HIV-infected persons that were contributed by all the alpha sites, including Koronga and Klabisa, that have relatively short follow-up times. These data are based on all HIV-infected persons, not just the seroconverters. These are prevalent cases. They number 16,200 people and approximately 58,000 person years of observation, about four times as much data as are available for seroconverters. The data suggests that age-specific mortality in the HIV-positive is higher in mature epidemics, but follows a fairly regular pattern, which can also actually be represented by Weibull distributions. These age schedules may also be useful for population projections, especially as they do not require a knowledge of HIV incidence patterns, only a knowledge of prevalence by age. Okay, the take-home message is that, and the relationship of our findings to the numbers, is that the previous UNAIDS estimates all assumed that median survival was just over 9 years, the net median survival. And this was based on evidence from only one cohort study, the Masaka study, which was able to publish the data several years ago. Now we're using a median survival of 11.5 years for Africa and of around 7 years for some Asian epidemics. The evidence for Asia, of course, is much more limited because we only have Thailand to draw on. So the new projections imply slower epidemic growth in Africa, possibly faster epidemic growth in some Asian countries. The speculations for the reason for the difference between the Thai studies and the African studies centers around viral subtypes, current thinking being that viral type A leads to slower progression and viral type D leads to faster progression. And I will just leave you with a reference to tell you where you can find more details about this study.
Thank you, Basia. Any questions for clarifications for the speaker? Or I'll keep it for later.
The next topic of this table is going to cover the issue of the estimates of HIV prevalence and its impact, and will be presented by my colleague from UNH, Eleanor Goves. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Paloma. I'm making this presentation on behalf of the UNAIDS and WHO Working Group on Global HIV Surveillance, and would like to describe very briefly the process of estimating HIV prevalence and its impact in countries, and then talk a little bit about the factors that have influenced the estimates in recent years. I would like to start by just showing you a few slides on the current status of the epidemic, all of which are published in the 2008 Global Report, and I'm sure most of you would have seen many of these. At the end of 2007, we estimated that approximately 33 million people were living with HIV, with an uncertainty range of 30 to 36 million. Of these people, we estimate that 2.7 million were newly infected in 2007, and 2 million died of AIDS in the same year. Looking at the distribution of infections across the different regions, we can immediately see that the majority of infections, in fact almost 70%, occurring in sub-Saharan Africa, with large numbers also in South and Southeast Asia, and in Latin America, where 1.7 million people are infected with HIV. In terms of the number of people newly infected with HIV, again, we can see that the majority occurred in sub-Saharan Africa, with much smaller numbers elsewhere in the world. This slide shows the regional distribution of adult and child deaths from AIDS in 2007. Global prevalence is estimated to have stabilized at just under 1%, while sub-Saharan Africa is one of the regions where prevalence has shown a slight decline over the last few years, although prevalence in 2007 was still very high at about 5%. Despite the global HIV prevalence having stabilized, you can see that the number of people living with HIV is still showing a slight increase, which is mainly the result of population growth. On this slide, you can also see, again, the disproportionate impact of HIV in sub-Saharan Africa as compared to the rest of the world. We estimate that global incidence of HIV peaked around 1996, with a subsequent decline in the numbers to the estimate of 2.7 million in 2007. And in terms of mortality, we estimate that mortality has started to decline in the last 2 years, since 2005, which is most probably the result of provision of antiretroviral therapy. So estimates of HIV prevalence and impact are regularly revised, mainly as a result of new data becoming available. And generally, the revisions and changes in estimates over time are the results of firstly improved surveillance, secondly increasing number of countries now conducting national population-based household surveys in which HIV testing is included, improved assumptions in estimation process as a result of more research, and finally, as a result of ongoing revision of our methodology. But before looking at each of these in a little more detail, I would like to start by just showing you the estimation process in countries. So essentially what happens in countries with generalized epidemics, we depend very heavily on surveillance data collected over time from pregnant women attending antenatal clinic or antenatal clinics. We then take this data over time and put it in the estimation and projection package known as EPP. And from EPP, we fit an adult HIV prevalence curve. Now, if countries also have national population-based surveys, often this curve is scaled to match the population-based survey estimate for the year in which the survey was done. We then take this HIV prevalence curve projected over time together with population estimates and together with epidemiological assumptions and data on program coverage, and we put that in a different package called Spectrum. And from Spectrum, we then estimate the demographic impact. So from Spectrum, we then estimate the number of people living with HIV, the number of new HIV infections in a country, AIDS deaths, number of orphans as a result of AIDS, and we also estimate antiretroviral therapy and PMTCT needs. In terms of the epidemiological assumptions that go into the model, we firstly, as explained by Basha, look at the progression from HIV infection to death. We also look at the distribution of HIV infection by age and by sex. And here, for example, we need to make assumptions about female-to-male ratios, as well as age distributions. Then we also make assumptions about fertility and the reduction in fertility as a result of HIV, as well as mother-to-child transmission rates. Then we also need data on treatment coverage, including estimates of the number of mothers receiving PMTCT services, number of children receiving treatment, both antiretrovirals and cotrimoxazole, as well as the number of adults receiving treatment. And I just want to emphasize at this point that this process is not only a Geneva-based exercise. We work very closely with national teams when making these estimates in countries. For countries with concentrated epidemics or low-level epidemics, the process is very much the same, with the exception that here we rely on surveillance data and size estimates for high-risk populations as well as for low-risk populations. We then can also use the EPP package if we have good data over time, or alternatively we can use the workbook from which we then again fit the adult prevalence curve, which then again together with the population estimates and epidemiological assumptions go into Spectrum. As mentioned, our estimates are frequently revised, and they generally improve over time. In recent years, from 2005 to 2007, we have seen a substantial downward revision of our estimates, and this revision was firstly related to improved surveillance. Specifically, HIV surveillance systems have expanded and improved considerably in the past few years, most notably in sub-Saharan Africa and in Asia. Surveillance data also improve as the number of surveillance rounds and the geographical and population coverage increase. And I just want to point out that as surveillance systems expand in countries, they often include more sites from rural areas where HIV prevalence is typically lower than in urban areas. and hence that would result in estimates that have to be revised downward. As an example of expanded surveillance systems in India, the number of Sentinel surveillance sites increased to more than 1,000 in 2006, and this was up from 155 in 1998, and they also now cover more extensively the most at-risk populations. And then in some countries that previously had limited HIV prevalence data, specifically countries such as Angola, Liberia, and Sudan, the recent rounds of Sentinel surveillance have provided more representative data. The second reason for recent changes in the estimates relate to more and more countries having conducted national population-based surveys in which HIV testing has been included. Now, national surveys and antenatal clinic surveillance both have strengths and weaknesses, but together we believe that they can provide complementary information and can provide a much clearer picture of both overall trends and geographical coverage. Specifically, while antenatal clinic surveillance provide good trend data, the national surveys are generally geographically more representative because they include large samples of both men and women, of people from different age categories, as well as from different geographic locations. When comparing the adult HIV prevalence estimates from national population-based surveys to ANC-based estimates in about 20 countries that have conducted such surveys between 2001 and 2005, you can see on this slide that the ANC-based estimates, which are given here as the red dots, almost always overestimate national prevalence. In fact, on average, the antenatal clinic-based prevalence overestimates population-based survey estimates by about 20%. So in the estimation process, the prevalence curve over time is informed by the antenatal clinic surveillance data over time, and it could typically look something like this blue line. And then for countries where we have national population-based survey or surveys, for example, given here by this red dot, the curve will then be scaled to match the prevalence for that year in which the survey was done. And of course, we need to emphasize also that we do look at the survey methodology and make sure that it is sound and reliable. And so often, this leads to a reduction in the prevalence curve in those countries in which surveys have been conducted. In addition to informing the calibration process in countries with surveys, the comparison between the antenatal clinic-based data and national surveillance survey estimates can also help to inform the adjustment that's needed in countries without such surveys. In this slide, we have calculated the ratio of population-based surveys to antenatal clinic-based prevalence for all the countries with surveys for both urban and rural areas. And as you can see, most of the ratios were below one, with the exceptions of a few countries. The median then across these surveys was about 0.8 for both urban as well as for rural areas, implying that antenatal clinic-based prevalence needs to be adjusted downward by about 20%. Now, previously in the estimation process, we had only adjusted rural areas, but with this new data from population-based surveys, we now think that both urban as well as rural prevalence estimates need to be adjusted. And this change this data was also implemented in the latest estimation round, which further contributed to the downward reduction in estimates. Then one of the major contributors of the downward reduction in HIV estimates between 2005 and 2007 was the revision of estimates in India. And essentially three things happened in India in recent years. Firstly, the number of Sentinel surveillance sites increased to more than 1,000 in 2006. Secondly, a large national population-based survey was conducted in 2006 in which HIV testing was included, and we learned a lot from this survey in which more than 100,000 participants were sampled. And then finally, the methodology in India was improved, and this was nicely presented by Dr. Lali Dandona earlier this week. So as a result, the estimates of the number of people living with HIV in India was revised from over 5 million in 2005 to 2.5 million in 2007. And this revision alone contributed significantly to the reduction in the global estimate of number of people living with HIV. I'm not going to say much about this slide because Basia explained it very nicely in her presentation, but just want to point out that as more data become available, we also revise some of the assumptions in our methods. And then finally, our methods are constantly reviewed and revised, and under the guidance of the UNAIDS Reference Group on Estimates, Modeling, and Projections, scientific meetings are held at least twice a year, during which the current methods and assumptions, as well as new data and research, are reviewed, and often leading to revisions in the methodology where necessary. And then just to mention also that our methods and updates are frequently published in peer-reviewed journals, and for those of you who are interested, the latest UNAIDS and WHO estimation methods are described in the July 2008 edition of Sexually Transmitted Infections. So in conclusion, the estimation process provides estimates that are essential for planning of care and support programs. It provides us with estimates of the number of people living with HIV, number of people dying from AIDS, number in need of PMTCT services, number in need of antiretroviral therapy, as well as number of orphans and orphans as a result of AIDS. So generally, our estimates have improved over time, and as a result of the improved surveillance and national survey data, we now do believe that we have more precise estimates compared to previous years. Thank you.
We have time for two questions to clarify the information that Eleanor has provided.
Everything is clear. Can we pass to the next speaker? Dr. Yves Souterrain, who happens also to be my boss, going to talk about the ART needs. And the title presentation is... ART Change. Universal access to ART, a moving target. So basically, we're talking about one of the products of the estimation process, that is, how many people need the ART?
Thank you, Chema. It's an honor for me to work with you. Señoras, señores, buenas tardes. I would like to in this presentation, to highlight some conceptual and methodological issues to monitor progress toward universal access to antiretroviral treatment and discuss some programmatic consequences, as it is an area in which there are some controversies and different approach. So I will first provide some background about scaling up ART. I will focus on the notion of needs and try to identify different approach of the notion of needs of ART. I will go in a little bit more detail on the process for estimating needs and provide some what are the methods and new assumptions that are incorporated in the process of need estimation, give a few words about what could be the needs in the future, and some words also about some programmatic implication. I am not sure that it is very necessary to remember to this audience that the first time the notion of universal access was discussed in a high-level consultation was at the G8 in 2005 in Gleneagles, when the G8 members committed to work with WHO, UNAIDS, and other international bodies to develop and implement a package of HIV prevention, treatment, and care with the aim of as close as possible toward universal access to treatment for those in need in 2010. And this target became a commitment of all UN member states that commit themselves to setting ambitious national targets that reflect the commitment of the present declaration and the urgent need to scale up significantly toward universal access by 2010. The UN resolution put emphasis on the principle of country ownership, with countries developing their own process for setting targets. And if we look at the recent UNX Global Report, a large number of countries have set targets in different areas, including in antiretroviral treatment. And in this area, targets are based on need coverage. It means the proportion of people in need of the intervention who have access to this intervention. A difficulty in the art area is linked in the absence of a unique definition of needs, making difficult comparisons of targets and progress between countries and monitoring regional and global response. Let me first give you, remind you a couple of data. I think that this slide has been the most presented during the conference, but as this slides come from the report that WHO UNS has published recently, I have the opportunity to present it. This data shows that the tremendous progress in access to treatment in the next couple of years, with 3 million achieved at the end of 2007, it means 15 times more than in 2003, and progress has been especially substantial in sub-Saharan Africa, which 54% increase between 2006 and 2007. This table gives the figures of the previous graph, and it especially reminds that the global coverage rate of treatment needs at the global level is 31%, with a range 27 to 34%, and we can see that it is in this region, in Latin America and Caribbean, that we have the highest coverage, 62%, in sub-Saharan Africa, 30%, and lower figures, especially in North Africa and the Middle East, with 7%. I would like to focus the rest of my presentation about this column, estimated needs, and we see that the estimated global needs in treatment is not far to be 10 million at the end of 2007, with a range between 8.7 to 11 million. Regarding needs, there are conflicting figures. If you look at the report that has been published by the three organizations in 2007 and in 2008 regarding the global estimated needs in 2006, you have two different figures. I repeat, for the same years, 2006, in the report of 2007, we published a figure of 7.1 million, when in the report of 2008, we published a figure of 9.3 million. I would like to explain why. We have also other conflicting figures related to country estimated needs. And for example, in the progress report of 2007, I give two examples, but there are many others. If we look, we provide country-reported needs, the data that the country themselves have reported. In Ukraine, the figure is 22,000, when UNAIDS and WHO, so their model, estimated at 91,000. And in Cameroon, we have also substantial difference, with a country-reported need of 86,000 and a modeling point estimate of 180,000. These data are published in the report. These country data are published, so you can have a look at them if you're interested. So let's go back to this notion of needs, and let's try to respond to the questions, who needs antiretroviral treatment? And we have roughly three main categories of people who are in need of ART. First, people who are currently receiving treatment and who are still on ART, and we know that these people, we need ART probably for the rest of their life. The second category is people who know their HIV status, who match treatment eligibility criteria, but do not have access to treatment. And the third category is people who are not aware of their HIV status, but theoretically meet criteria for initiating treatment. We can also, for the second category, people who know their status but do not have access, have two subcategories, people who are still on care but have not access to antiretroviral treatment, and people who are not yet followed up in the healthcare system, they know their status, but they have not access for the follow-up of their HIV/AIDS status. These different categories correspond to different programmatic areas. For the first, ensuring long-term adherence and patient retention on ART. For the second, ensuring access to drugs to those who are not yet treated. And for the third, ensuring access to testing and counseling. And for estimation of this group, we could have also different process. For group 1 and group 2A, these groups can be estimated based on health facility statistics, when for group 3 and group 2B, this needs modeling or special surveys. So it means there are different approaches for treatment needs. We can differentiate two main approaches. The first is what we can call the programmatic approach, which is used by some countries who develop their own estimation and targets, considering only category 1 and 2, I mean only people who are aware of their HIV status. And for this country, priority is given to sustaining treatment to those already treated and to giving access to those being follow-up. The modeling approach, which is developed by WHO and UNAIDS, includes all people in need, regardless of whether they know their HIV status. It's probably a more comprehensive approach of universal access, even if the two categories have their own rationale and should be, could be estimated. In the report by WHO and UNAIDS, both needs estimation are published when available, but coverage monitoring as well as global and regional analysis are done using only the modeling approach, because it's the only approach for which we can have real comparative data between countries. For the programmatic approach, as it's a process developed by countries themselves, we don't every time know what is the process developed by country, and we can't use this data for comparing countries. So let's go back now to this process of modeling approach, which has still been developed by Eleonore in her presentation. To estimate treatment needs, WHO and UNAIDS have developed different tools, especially the Spectrum software, which produces estimation of different variables that are determined as consequence of prevalence estimates, including the number of people on treatment. These tools are developed based on the recommendation of the reference group on estimates, modeling, and projections, and it provides not only point estimates, but also plausibility range, because there is a lot of uncertainty when developing this estimation, especially the parameters have their own uncertainty, and we need to develop them with plausibility range. So Spectrum estimates the total number of people who are eligible to ART, based on the epidemic profile of the country, and parameters on survival and disease progression, especially survival without ART, and time from infection to treatment eligibility. The criteria that are used for ART eligibility are following the WHO recommendation. People who are in urgent need of ART, people are considered in urgent need of ART when they match with the WHO recommendation, either less than 200 CD4, either in WHO stage 4 disease, or in a combination of WHO stage 3 and less than 300 CD4. In 2007, and this has been already presented by the previous presenters, new assumptions and key parameters have been incorporated into estimation methods based on the latest evidence, especially from cohort studies like Alpha Network and also ARTLINK, which are it's a network of people still on treatment. And many key parameters for estimation has been changed. For example, and it has been presented early, median time from infections to death in the absence of treatment has been increased from 9 to 11 years, because evidence shows that the time for infection to death has increased, is longer than it was previously estimated. Median time for infection to eligibility of ART now it's, it was before, previously was estimated at 7 years, and now people are considered as matching eligibility criteria after 8 years after the infections. Median time from eligibility for ARDS to death in absence of ARDS, it is the same. The parameters was previously estimated to 2 years, and now it is estimated to 3 years. So it means that people in need are people who will die in the next 3 years in absence of treatment. And finally, probability of survival for adult on ARDS is 0.85 the first years and 0.95 the following years. So this change in the parameters have occurred, this change of the estimation. And if you look at this table, which presents estimation of needs with back calculation, it means that we have recalculated the needs based on these new parameters for the previous years. Just to look at the year 2006, this explains why we report on 7.1 million estimated needs in the report of 2007, but now we know that in 2006 there were 9.3 million people in need, and in 2007 there are 9.7 million people in need. So what needs will change every time? As Peter Piot said yesterday in his presentation on AIDS in 2031, today maybe 33 million people are in need because there are 33 million people on treatment. So what will influence our needs? First, treatment guidelines themselves. If there is a consensus between the community, between academics and people who are working on the treatment guidelines, that treatment initiation should now move to 350 CD4, this would increase ART needs. And for example, for children, there are some revision of children, children treatment recommendation. Recommendations are currently on revision, and the estimation will be affected by this revision, as now all HIV-positive children less than 12 months should start ART, when before it was linked with clinical and immunological stage. So we can expect in the next estimation process of treatment need for children a very substantial increase in needs. The epidemic itself also influenced ART needs. In the late 90s, around more than 3 million people were infected each year, and now these people are reaching eligibility criteria to access ART. And finally, the pace of scale-up, because due to lower mortality among people on ART, an accelerated scaling up will increase the total number of people in need. So just to give you figures, and this is estimated by UNAIDS, but this estimation has not yet been published. If we consider the same treatment guidelines, and if we consider a constant treatment increase, I mean 1 million more people on treatment every year, adult needs in 2010 will increase of 1.8 million, and the coverage in 2010 will reach only, because 50% is not universal access, but will reach 50% of needs. And in 2015, with the same treatment increase, it will reach 64%. I have already go over my time, but I hope that you will give 1 or 2 minutes more. I have 2 slides, I think, yes. So let's just think about some programmatic consequences of this data. At the end of 2007, among 33 million people living with HIV/AIDS, and among them, 9.7 million are in need, including 3 million which are still on treatment. We know also, this is of course, all these data include a lot of uncertainty, and I should present range. I don't present range for the sake of the presentation, but we know by a population-based survey that there is a median of only 20% people living with HIV/AIDS who know their status. It means 6.6 million who know their status, including 3 million on treatment. This means that among the 6.5 million people who are not treated but need treatment, less than at the maximum of 3.6 million are aware of the status, and 3.6 million will be in the very improbable case of all people aware of their status are in need of treatment. Now let's look of, on data that has been presented last week. I'm sorry, I'm not sure that this slide is quite readable. But it's very interesting data in, from Kenya, from only one country, was published last week, is last population-based survey on AIDS, which the circle represents all people in need, with 35% who are still on ART. Only 2% people in need of ART who know their status, and a large majority of people who need ART who do not know their status and are so not still on ART. If we apply these figures of 2% to the global population, it's an extrapolation, and surely it's not the case, but if we apply this global, to the global level, it means that today there are only 200,000 people who are in need of ART, who know their status, but don't have access to ART. So in conclusion, country target settings and monitoring processes should be based on a unified vision of needs. Both approach, I mean the programmatic approach and the modeling approach, are complementary, but they don't measure the same. The programmatic approach captures only a fraction of the universal access target, and the modeling approach captures a broader approach, but is based on assumption, it's complex to measure, and it's based on assumptions that need regular updates. Second, country need will continue to increase when scaling up access. It means that if we want to see the coverage, the global coverage of need increase, we need to make sure that not only needs will increase, but also the number of people accessing to ART increase more than the needs. And at the current pace, global need coverage will be only 50% at the end of 2010. A more ambitious achievement will depend first on substantial increase of resources and also on country capacity to add more than 1 million people on treatment each year, but also a huge scaling up of testing and counseling, as few people in need are aware of their HIV status. I think time is over, so thank you. Muchas gracias.
Any questions of clarification for Dr. Itzutera? Otherwise.
Our next speaker is John Stover, and he's going to be presenting the estimating the impact and needs for children and PMTCT. He is the director of Future Institute in USA.
Thank you, Paloma. Just to review a slide that Eleanor showed you in the earlier presentation about the process that's used to make these projections. As she showed, we start with surveillance data and use a program called EPP or Workbook to estimate adult prevalence. And that goes into Spectrum along with assumptions about demography, epidemic patterns, and program coverage to estimate the additional indicators of interest. So the adult prevalence input and the demographic inputs are key to the estimates that we're going to make about children. Also, all the previous presentations you've seen, presentation by Basha about the survival of people with HIV, presentation by Eve on the impact of ART on survival, all of those assumptions and processes are going to be affecting our estimate of children in need. The starting point is an estimate of the number of births that are taking place to women who are HIV positive. So when we do this modeling for each country, we have total fertility rates from the demographic information from each country. And generally, we draw the demographic information either from the UN Population Division or countries provide their own demographic information and projections. We have information from the prevalence surveys that I mentioned earlier that tell us about the percentage of women that are HIV positive. So then we want to know, what is the fertility of HIV positive women? Well, a number of studies have shown us that it's somewhat different from the fertility of HIV negative women. In particular, for the youngest age group, 15 to 19, many women, in most countries, most women, are not actually sexually active. So we know that they're all HIV negative. So if the only thing you know about a young woman is that she's HIV positive, you also know that she's sexually active. and therefore actually more likely to be pregnant than an HIV-negative woman. But over the age 20, where the majority of women are sexually active, that process is not active anymore. But we do see from a number of different studies that HIV-positive women have lower fertility than HIV-negative women. So in our estimates, we assume that the fertility of HIV-positive women is about 70% of that of HIV-negative women. So once we have an estimate of number of births taking place to HIV-positive women, we need to estimate the transmission of the virus from the mother to her newborn child. And you're all aware that there's really four pillars of the program to prevent mother-to-child transmission. It starts with primary prevention for women, and that is already encompassed in our estimates of prevalence. A second pillar is family planning to prevent unintended pregnancies among HIV-positive women. At the moment, we're not assuming any differential use of family planning among HIV-positive women as opposed to HIV-negative women. There's been a lot of discussion at this conference about integrating family planning and HIV and providing better family planning services to HIV-positive women. So in the future, we may have to modify that approach. The third pillar is the prevention of the vertical transmission from mother to child, and that involves testing and counseling, antiretroviral prophylaxis, safe delivery, counseling, and support for safer infant feeding. So let's focus now on that aspect of it. First, the prophylaxis to prevent mother-to-child transmission. There are a variety of different approaches that are used in countries. We've simplified them into these four approaches. So one is single-dose nevirapine. A second is some kind of dual ARV regimen. Third one is a few countries are using triple ARTs. And then the fourth one is that the woman is on triple ART to treat her own infection, which means that she was probably on ART before becoming pregnant. She was on it for her entire pregnancy and will continue after the pregnancy. So one of the efforts of the UNAIDS reference group is to review all the different scientific studies that have been undertaken that look at different combinations of regimens and different amounts of breastfeeding or replacement feeding or exclusive breastfeeding. So we've examined all the different studies that are available, and from those studies tried to extract this table that tells us the probability that an HIV-positive woman would transmit the virus to her newborn child depending on the prophylaxis regimen offered to her and depending on the infant feeding practices after birth. So this table shows you that it could be as high as 30% if there's no prophylaxis and mixed breastfeeding, and as low as 2% if the woman is on triple therapy and uses replacement feeding. So of course, for each country, we'll use the program statistics to tell us what proportion of women fall into each one of these boxes, and from that we make an estimate of the number of children that are HIV positive at birth or infected through breastfeeding. So the program statistics come in here when we need to know what proportion of women are receiving any kind of PMDCT program and the type of program that they have. And this chart just shows you the results published in the Universal Access Report that suggests that globally about one-third of women are having access to PMDCT programs. And the current distribution of regimens is about half are receiving single-dose nevirapine, which cuts the transmission rates by about half. About a quarter or so are receiving some kind of dual ARV now, and that number is increasing significantly. And then another 8% or so are on triple ARVs and 17% that we just don't actually know what they're receiving. So then, if a child is HIV positive at birth or infected through breastfeeding, we, in the modeling, we track that child from new infection through a progression period, time when the child's infected but not asymptomatic, to a period when the child begins to need treatment. And then from that point on, if the child gets treatment, they'll have one outcome. If the child does not get treatment, they'll have another outcome. The progression from need for treatment to AIDS death depends on the age of the child, as does the effectiveness of heart in postponing death. So first, what do we assume about the progression of children from the time they become infected until the time they would die from AIDS if no treatment is available? Well, a number, some studies have looked at this, and this is a summary curve that has been produced based on a whole variety of studies that have looked at progression for different periods of time. So we have quite a few studies that look at this progression in the first, second, and even third years of the child's life. We actually have no studies that inform this curve up to age 10 or 11, for example. But basically what we see is that some children are fast progressors. In other words, they progress very rapidly from infection to AIDS and to death without treatment. Some children are slow progressors. They survive to age 5 and then have a progression period that looks very much like the adult patterns that Basha was showing earlier. We think that this is related to time of infection, that children infected intrapartum tend to be the fast progressors, and those infected through breastfeeding tend to be the slow progressors. But in any case, we have this curve that describes children advancing to HIV, to AIDS death. And then this blue curve, following along what Eve showed you for adults, this curve shows you the progression to need for treatment. So at some period, 2 or 3 years before death, children's immune systems will deteriorate to the point where they could benefit from ART treatment, and then we classify these children as in need of treatment. Now, it's not just ART that's available for treating children, but also cotrimoxazole has been shown to have an effect on reducing mortality among HIV-positive children. Since we often don't know whether a child born to an HIV-positive mother is infected for 18 months, if we're doing an antibody test that takes that long for the mother's antibodies to be cleared from the child's blood. So the recommendation is that all HIV-exposed children should be on cotrimoxazole until they're either no longer exposed to HIV or confirmed through some test to be HIV negative. Impact estimates come from one study, a study published by Chintu and colleagues in Zambia, that showed a 33% reduction in mortality in the first 4 years on cotrimoxazole. And we've assumed that that effect lasts for 5 years, but not after 5 years. It's interesting that most national policies now include cotrimoxazole prophylaxis because of this study that showed significant effects. And after all, cotrimoxazole is an inexpensive drug and fairly easy to administer, but coverage is currently quite low. UNICEF and others are certainly making estimates to try to improve that, but currently it's not making a big impact at the global level. For ART, treatment need is based on this estimate of the proportion of children progressing to moderate severe disease, in which case they would be in need of ART. The WHO recommendation is that for children over the age of 1, you should start ART based on these immunological and clinical criteria, and we have operationalized that in our model on the basis of those curves that I showed you. I think Eve mentioned that the new recommendations coming out about starting all children under 1 who are known to be HIV positive on ART is being integrated into the model now, so this is going to change our estimates of children in need of ART in the future because of that change in guidelines. So what do we assume about the impact of ART on child survival? Here we have three studies, really, two from Cote d'Ivoire that report on the same cohort, different periods, and one from Thailand. Based on that research, we assume that the survival of children on ART, if the child's under age 1, is about 80%, and if over age 1, 90% in the first year and 95% in subsequent years. So similar to the estimates we have for adults. So these estimates then are put together into the model along with then the country-specific information about prevalence, demographic information about fertility rates, distribution of population, as well as the program-specific information about number of people on ART, both adults and children, and mother-to-child PMTCT programs to prevent mother-to-child transmission. And these result then in estimates from the beginning of the epidemic in each country up to 2007 and then beyond, of the number of children who are born with infection, who survive with that infection through their life, or develop AIDS and die, get on treatment, and survive. And so that combination of all those assumptions put together with the epidemiological processes produces the estimates that you've seen presented this week and in the UNAIDS report on number of children living with HIV, number of children in need of treatment for both ART, cotrimoxazole, and number of people in need of programs to prevent mother-to-child transmission. Thank you.
Gillian, any question, any clarification to this presentation? Then we move on.
Okay, and our last speaker is Enrique Bravo. He's the statistician and the person who takes care of estimates in Mexico. And just for the people to know, maybe they're not fully aware, but HIV estimates in 1990 used to be a top-down approach in the sense that the estimates by regions and countries were done in Geneva by the group of people. So things have changed a lot since 1990s. And now, the last several years, UNAIDS and WHO have been trying to increase capacity in the countries. So really the estimates, the global estimate reported by UNAIDS this week, or this past week in the rural numbers, is more bottom-up approach in the sense that the countries submit the estimates at national level with the impacts, the number of people needing ART, children living with HIV, et cetera, and then the UNAIDS and WHO put that together. So, Enrique will give us a presentation in how has been the process and the impact of the numbers in Mexico.
Okay, thanks, Jaime. Okay, good afternoon, everybody. Buenas noches a todos. Thanks. Thanks a lot to World Health Organization and UNAIDS for inviting me to participate in this session. And thanks to all for staying here. This is the 5 year of the conference. It's 8 o'clock p.m. and you are here. I appreciate. I would like to speak in English. But as you can hear, really I don't speak English, so I have to speak in Spanish. However, I create the slides in English.
So we're going to present the Mexican experience in making HIV estimates. First of all, I'd like to refer to the epidemics in Mexico. Basically, Mexico has a very concentrated type of epidemics where the overall population is very low, 0.3%, and it's been stable over the past few years. This is spread primarily through sex in Mexico, accounting for about 90% of all of the cases of AIDS. And it's a concentrated type of epidemia. It's basically men having sex with men, which is 11%, injecting drug users, which represents about 6% of prevalence, and female sex workers, 2%. Now, the good news that we have for Mexico is that we're one of the lowest countries showing prevalence throughout Latin America, as you can see up on the graph, that we're at the end of the line with the prevalence of HIV. However, the bad news is that if we take into account the number of people who live with this disease, we're in the second place, almost at the top, right after Brazil, with 200,000 people who are living with this disease. The other point that we need to take into account for the Mexican situation is our geographical location, where we precisely have borders with the United States to the north with a greater prevalence, which is double that of Mexico. And to the south, we find countries such as Guatemala, Belize, El Salvador, and Honduras, which also have higher figures than we do. So the migratory phenomenon, of course, also means that Mexico is the only country of this region where it both is a source of origin of migration and is really a border, which is a country which is crossed, and is also the destination. So this, of course, increases the possibility of propagation of this disease. Before we had these UN AIDS workshops and its methodology to make these estimates in different countries, Mexico had already developed its own HIV estimates. Mexican methodology has a very limited type of methodology because all we do is to take into account the size of the high-risk populations and their HIV prevalence. The low-risk population was not included in the models that we used in Mexico. And for regional estimates, for example, of each one of the states of the country, Mexico used a compound index based on the information that we had of HIV, the new cases which were reported, AIDS cases, and AIDS deaths. So taking into account these three different aspects, we were able to define a specific index, and then we certainly weighted it throughout the different states in the country, and made an estimate of the index for each different region. Once we worked with UNAIDS on regional workshops to train the countries in making better estimates, Mexico started participating in the year 2003 in these workshops. It was in Guatemala 2003, in Guatemala once again 2005, and just recently in Panama in 2007. And all of these workshops, Mexico has sent at least one expert. And what's really important is that Mexico has always sent the same person to these workshops, and that has meant that we have been able to better use the experience. In other countries, sometimes they've had to change the person that they send every couple of years and thus lose continuity. From this experience that Mexico's had by attending these workshops, Mexico had a national workshop in 2006 with the participation of our 32 states in place throughout the country. And we also had experts from UNAIDS and the World Health Organization. And here Jesus Maria Garcia Callejo, who was helping us out by participating in the workshop in Mexico in 2006 and once again in 2007. At these, we made regional estimates of the people who were infected and lived with HIV, and that means that our level of experience here in Mexico has greatly increased, and we've been able to participate even more and help with the estimates that were made in Panama last year. Now we've already heard from my fellow panelists that we've made Epidemia. We use the UNAIDS workbook software and the Spectrum software from the Constella group. As we've already heard, the workbook method is really a spreadsheet. It's used to look at the HIV prevalence in each one of these groups, and by combining these two criteria, then we reach an estimate of the people who are infected with VIH. Then we export these data to Spectrum, and here are the values in Mexico up on the screen. As you can see, the most affected group, of course, are the men having sex with men, between 7% to 20%. Second place, if men have sex with men, 7% to 15%. Male sex workers, and then men having sex with men. Then we have female sex workers, clients of sex workers, injected drug users, and prisoners. Through these different components of workbook, we are able to point to the prevalence And then we developed the epidemic curve, the logistic curve in workbook, and then send the information on as output for spectrum. This was the first curve that we were able to draw in workbook to model what is happening with AIDS in Mexico. The spectrum model, we use the AIDS model, the AIDS impact model, AIM. It's a computer program for projecting the impact of the AIDS epidemic, the number of people living with HIV, adult HIV prevalence, number of new HIV infections, new AIDS cases, total number needing ART, etc. In addition to AIDS deaths, and of course, we do this every 2 years precisely with CONOCIDA. So here's the spectrum software up on the screen. It's based on Windows. It's free of charge. It's user-friendly. And Spectrum is available directly on this web page. And we certainly have John Stover here with us. John Stover was the person who developed this Spectrum model. Now, what are the results that we've had here in Mexico? Here's our estimate of HIV prevalence in Mexico from 1990 to 2007, where it's 0.34% with a range, the highest range, the lower and upper ranges of prevalence. And here's the estimation, the estimate for people who are living with HIV. On an average, it's 200,000 people, but it could go between 100,000 and all the way up to 300,000 is a possibility, with a median of 200,000. Well, I think the most important thing of all this is really how are we going to apply these HIV estimates? What are we going to do with all these figures for our programs that we're developing here in Mexico? We carried out a first application. We presented this 2 days ago in one of the sessions here at the conference. This is just a brief overview or summary of this. We estimated, using antiretrovirals from 2010, ARV needs between 1983 and 2010. We took this information from the people who are receiving ARV treatment in Mexico, and through the different sources of information that we have in Mexico, we use this and compare the two curves. I think you know that in Mexico from 2001 on, the federal government made the decision to provide universal access to everybody. And this was achieved in 2004. So in Mexico, there is universal access to antiretroviral drugs, and this was a government decision. However, when we look at the curves in the blue line, we see the estimated people who need these antiretrovirals, a wide spectrum viral, and still in the previous version, we can see what you've brought up. This is a new version where you can see that we changed some of the different parameters, and the estimate of these ARVs is much higher. This study is still based on the previous spectrum version, and we can see how we began the ARV in Mexico in 2001, and after that, the red line shows how we've been able to increase the number of people who receive ARV treatment. According to this study, the prevalence that was estimated was 98.5% of coverage, not 100%. Why? Here are some of the results that tries to explain the coverage, the number of people who are under treatment in Mexico, and the comparison between the two curves that you just saw. And according to this, we would still have 500 to 600 people who might not be receiving any ARV treatment. Why can't we achieve this 100% coverage? Well, some of the possible explanations that we've been able to find are the stigma, discrimination, homophobia. These three factors, I think, taken together are very, very important, especially for an epidemic, and the group that's most highly affected are men who have sex with men. And we also have problem geographical, cultural, linguistic barriers. Also personal decisions, and also people who decide not to receive this treatment. And finally, something that Jeeves mentioned in his presentation, people who are not aware of their HIV status. So the challenge for Mexico is to provide ARV to 100% of the population who wishes to receive this treatment. What have we learned from all of this? First of all, that Mexico has, from 2003 on, has gradually adopted the UN AIDS methodology, which has certainly allowed us to have better estimates. And we have a group of experts here in Mexico on estimates, and we've been able to build regional estimates to define the target populations. This means that, first of all, the first case we put up, that we've been able to evaluate real coverage of the retroantiviral treatments, and we've also been able to estimate the sizes of our target population and also information which allows us to evaluate the impact of prevention programs in Mexico. So just to wind up, I'd like to make a comment, one final comment. You've seen here the logo for the conference here in Mexico. It's a red kind of a bow or ribbon, and it's in the form of a snake. And this, who's the snake? This is Quetzalcoatl. He is an important god, one of the most important gods in Mesoamerica. It's a combination of the word Quetzal and Coatl, which means snake. So this is the feathered snake, and here you can see our logo. And at the top, this is a pre-Hispanic, a pre-colonial code, where Quetzalcoatl is eating a person to offer the body to the gods. Thank you very much.
It's always nice to talk to Enrique because she always teaches you something about the culture in Mexico. So I think we have five wonderful speakers and presentations, and we have seen how Basia has taking us from the basic research, from cohort studies in Africa, how this basic research is really feeding the HIV surveillance methodology and estimate process. And we have seen also with Eleanor John, how the methods have been developed, applied, and how we really using in the national estimates. If has proposed also a question or some of the hot issues that we have been seeing in the conference about the ART needs and coverage issues. And finally, we have seen with Enrique how it's not only a process that involves international agencies, but it's really a process in which the countries have been involved in the beginning and are applying that at a local level. So with these comments, I would like to open the floor for questions. So comments to the speakers or whoever. Otherwise, I can ask questions as well. Any volunteer? Ruti.
Hi, my name is Ruti Komatsu from Global Fund Secretariat. I have a question to probably for Eve. Maybe Eleanor. I think the estimating needs is very important, and setting target based on the needs is very important. But also, I think a realistic target that has been funded may be also very useful to understand. And we are trying to assess what we have as a global fund approval proposal, but we don't really have any other information, for example, from PEPFAR or other funders. Or I think UNAIDS has some target by country. And if Eve or Elena can comment, I would appreciate for that.
Yeah, I think we can answer that.
Okay, thank you, Richie, for your question. Well, I think that Eleanor can be maybe better placed than me to respond, because UNAIDS has published on its website the targets that different countries have already defined for the different interventions. And I think that in the global report we have a list of countries with proposed targets. But this is my own view. I think that we have not clarity about how this target has been fixed by most countries. And for example, just to go back to the two approaches that I tried to present it, some countries are using estimation based on current needs provided through spectrum. Some other countries are providing targets who are based on the only people who know the status. So I think we should work maybe more systematically with countries to have a better assessment of how this target has been developed. And WHO, we're working on technical tools for supporting countries who would like to revise their own targets, for countries who have not yet set their own targets, to try to harmonize a little bit the process for setting targets. The process itself is owned by countries. There is absolutely no discussion about that. But to have some technical assistance on that could maybe harmonize a little bit more how the different countries have set their own targets.
Yeah, I don't actually have anything further to add, but I just agree with Eve that the process happens in countries, and maybe it's time that we work more closely with countries on that.
Yeah, next question, please.
Yeah, my name is Patsy Sri Nilan from the Ministry of Public Health, Thailand. I have two questions. One about the survival rates, comparing between African and Thailand. And as you said, that the differences is seen among four variables of sex, females, not for male. Male is the same for Asia and Africa, for Thailand and Africa. So I would like to ask, because the data of Thailand is among army conscripts, so most of them are male. And I don't know whether about the blood donors, that affects the differences between these or not, no? Because for Thailand, for observation, we found out that for male, they die earlier than female. So that's one thing. The second thing is about the estimation of the denominators, because for UNCAS report, we are asked to use the denominators from the spectrums. But normally in Thailand, we use the Asian epidemic models. So what's the differences between those things, no? Because we are asked to use spectrum, not Asian epidemic models, for also PMTCT and also for the coverage of the ARV.
Pasha can answer the first question, probably John can answer the second.
Yeah. There were two studies from Thailand in the
studies that participated in the Alpha Network workshop on estimating survival. One, as you say, is the Thai military, which is, you're quite correct to say, 100% male. The other one is the study of blood donors and their partners, of whom 67% were male. It's quite true that the numbers, of course, it's only that study that can contribute to anything that we know about sex differentials in Thailand. And if we rely on only one study, then our overall numbers are small. But the finding that there was very little difference between males and females in survival post-infection was common to both the African studies and the Asian studies. So really, that was not a very surprising finding, and not unique to Thailand. I've forgotten what the first part of your question was. Yeah? It was this, that was the main part?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how to answer your question. The Asia epidemic model, I believe, uses the same prevalence inputs that go into spectrum. But I'm not sure that the Asia epidemic model has updated with the new progression curves that spectrum is using, so I would expect it to give somewhat lower estimates of ART coverage. Is that what you're finding?
Because I'm the users. I'm not the one who estimates. But I'm the user of the data, so I would like to understand what's the differences between spectrum and Asian epidemic models.
Yeah, certainly the demographic processes are somewhat different, but I don't think that would make much of a difference. So my guess is, and I'm not sure of this, is that, you know, Eve mentioned how we've changed our assumptions about survival from infection to need for treatment and need for treatment to death, that have the big impact on the estimate of needs. And I'm not sure that the Asia epidemic model has incorporated those changes yet. So I think it may be more comparable with the old version of spectrum than the new one. So I think that's the reason for the difference, but I can find out for you for sure. I'm not sure.
Thank you.
Okay, next question, please.
My name is Linus Bengtsson. I'm from Karolinska Institute and the Gapminder Foundation, and I have a question for Eleanor. It concerns the concentrated epidemics and the evolution of the prevalence curves. We saw one curve from Mexico, and I just want to comment on the shape of those curves. I think maybe this is not a new... I think there are some problematic issues there that might have been discussed within the EPI unit at UNAIDS, but the beginning for me to look at these curves was that within the Gapminder Foundation, we try to graphically illustrate a lot of statistics in the world, and I've been working with developing prevalence curves for countries looking at HIV prevalence, and I saw the UNAIDS curves for European countries. You have a quite slow increase in early in the epidemic. In the 90s, it goes up quite fast, and then it slows off, and you get this S-shaped curve. And looking at, when I looked at individual countries that have done estimates, for example, UK, Germany, Denmark, and a few other countries, you actually see when you look at the national data, a completely different shape, with a strong increase in the 80s, a flattening off during the 90s when people started dying and there were no ARTs, and then a strong increase now again when almost nobody's dying. And then now I observe the same curve in the Mexican presentation here, with this workbook curve with a lilac curve. You had a slow increase during the 80s, quick during the 90s, and now it leveled off. And just knowing it, I think the MSM incidence is quite high in Mexico, and given the ART coverage in Mexico of, I think you said, 98%, you would expect maybe a quite much stronger increase now and not really a leveling off. So I think this might not be a new thing. I think you've discussed maybe this in the EPI unit, but it seems that there is some things to work on in this concentrated workbook model.
Thanks very much for that question. That is indeed true that we are seeing some changes. In the past, we generally found that the logistic or the double logistic curve would fit the epidemic quite well because it would go up, then stabilize. In some countries, it would come down, and then we would fit the double logistic curve. But you're right, we're now aware of the increase again in some countries, especially with the rollout of antiretroviral therapy. We would very much like to actually receive some data from countries where they have curves that do that, because we do want to work on that, and we do want to see if we can we can develop a function that would fit that kind of data. So I would very much like to see some data. So far, we've heard from some European countries that that's happening, but I haven't actually seen some real data, so I would very much appreciate some data.
I think it could be very important because now for many concentrated epidemics, you see that the curves look like the epidemic is actually not a problem anymore, or it's leveling off when it's actually the opposite problem. Just a follow-up question. Is that, if you look at the Mexican situation, for example, would this, I'm not exactly sure how the model works, but would this kind of shape influence, for example, ART coverage estimates? Would it somehow influence other factors?
I'm not sure what you mean by other factors. From what I saw presented, it looked as if our simple logistic curve still fitted that data quite well, and that increase hasn't been that dramatic. But I don't know if you want to comment.
I think that you're right. Bueno, creo.
You have been okay. Thank you. Yo creo que ha sido muy
well. I think that you have made a very good observation acerca de México. Yo en México vi la cobertura.
University access is recently, 3 years from now. I think it's not possible in this time to evaluate the real impact in the cure. I think you have the reason, because many people extended your survival, and the cure has to modify the shape. I agree with you.
Okay, thank you for the comments. I can add another comment. It's just this process is a dynamic process, so every year there is the experts of the UNA's EPI reference group who meets and discuss the issues, new research, new data, and these methods are published. So it's a dynamic, and obviously this year again new assumptions are taking place and new discussions, so it will be evolving. Next question, please.
Buenas noches, Rafael.
Rafael Arana from Nicaragua. I want to know about the co-infection. Are you working on estimates or needs or projections by using these same models? And the second question, we are not talking about an economic impact by using these models, are we?
Una aclaración. Cuando hablas de coinfección.
When you say co-infection, what type of co-infection? TB? HIV-TB infection? Yes.
Who wants to answer?
Sorry, can you...
Okay. They didn't hit the translator, so they couldn't understand the question. But I can tell you the answer already, if I may. The second question, the economic impact.
Spanish? Okay. The economic impact is not included in this model because this model is just an epidemiological model. There are some other more sophisticated models that measure the economic impact. It's not been developed to measure the economic impact because the function of these groups of experts is just to see epidemiology and demographic impacts and of the disease. The first question has to do with the co-infection with TB and HIV. in what is spectrum, we have the module to project what is prevalence in the population. There is a component of TB we can work on. In fact, the TB program in Geneva uses prevalence of HIV in African countries to be the final burden of TB. But people using these models of reference, BPP or spectrum, people that work with VIH, do not use this model of TB. But in theory, it is there, and it might be used. But this is a program that has to be developed between TB and VIH. Did I explain myself? Okay. Siguiente pregunta.
Oops. Good evening. My name is Francis Akwan. I'm with the public sector HIV/AIDS program in a province in South Africa. My first question is to John Stover. I'd like to ask about estimates on AIDS orphaning. I know you didn't really specify or spend time on that. But most of the estimates from yours and other suits kind of give estimates that are completely not, or estimates that programs, on NGO programs and government programs cannot find these numbers. And they don't seem to be explained by being absorbed into the extended family system per se. And I'm speaking from the South African experience here. And I'm wondering whether you could speculate or propose some reason for this discrepancy. My second question is to Enrique Bravo Garcia. Thanks for the enlightening presentation on Mexico. And I'd like to know whether, I know you have a concentrated epidemic, but I'd like to know whether you have some prevalence data on your, that is, on your Native American population. Thank you.
If I understood your first question, it's that Spectrum is making estimates of numbers of orphans, but as program people trying to provide support to orphans, you're not seeing that many of them, right? And what's the reason? Well, first of all, you have to remember that the definition of an orphan that's used in Spectrum is any child under the age of 18 that's lost one or both parents. So some of these children have lost one parent, but may still be living with the other parent. So you wouldn't necessarily see them as in need of services. Secondly, this is all children under the age of 18. So some of these children may have been orphans for 12 years, in which case the mere fact that they've survived for 12 years means that they have, somehow or other, they are in a family situation where they're being taken care of. So again, they wouldn't necessarily appear to somebody trying to assess the need for orphan support as orphans. And the third reason, which I think we've seen, we've recently been doing some comparisons between the survey-based estimates of orphanhood and the model-based estimates. And one of the things that's come out of that that analysis is that often the surveys may underestimate the number of maternal orphans. And we think it's because if a child's mother dies and the child is then fostered or taken care of by, let's say, the mother's sister or some other close family member, the woman might report that child as an orphan if there's a survey that takes place in the next month or two. But if the survey takes place a year later, that child has been living in the family for a year and the woman just reports it as her child. So there's some I think reporting issues that would lead to lower numbers coming out of surveys. So I think the number of orphans coming out of a model like this is a demographic number, which might be very different from the number of children in need of support, which I think is what you're identifying through the community level.
Enrique?
Thanks for the question. Unfortunately, there is not in Mexico specific studies about HIV prevalence in indigenous population. The only information is all the people who are receiving antiretroviral therapy in Mexico, the 4% are indigenous people. The size of the indigenous people in Mexico are 10%. It's evident it's an inequality in access the indigenous people to the care services.
Any other question or comments? Otherwise, I make a couple of questions to the panel. Perhaps I would like to ask to everybody, what is probably, which additional research is needed in order to improve the methodology and HIV estimates? Another question could be also, should we have, you know, like this morning in the plenary, I cannot remember his name, it was Greg Gonzalez, I believe, he was asking, saying that we should have targets, global targets, national targets. So the question is, should we have targets for ART, for the needs, for the coverage, for MTCT, real targets? And my last question also for, I think for everybody, is about the ART needs among concentrated epidemics. As we have seen, it is a large variation, and if it was presenting how counties have some people presenting 100% coverage because they are based in people who are diagnosed, other countries have expressed the feeling that a spectrum overestimated their ART needs, and therefore the coverage was lower than they think it really is. So we maybe perhaps use spectrum for genetic epidemics for ART needs and to develop additional methods for lower level epidemics or concentrated epidemics. So we move change methods for ART specific needs, specifically for this kind of epidemics. So anybody can answer. Yeah, John?
For me, what I would like to see is we're always trying to improve our methods by comparing our model-based estimates with data from surveys or from programs. And so we've been doing that for years in terms of numbers of people infected, as Eleanor mentioned. It'd be nice if we could now start to do that for the needs-based estimate. So we have an estimate coming out of Spectrum that X number of people in a country are in need of ART. How can we compare that with some other way of making that same estimate? And I think for the first time this year, we do have one country where we can do that, the survey in Kenya, the AIDS Indicator Survey, which was just released last week, actually took a venous blood in order to do CD4 counts on all the HIV-positive people. So from that, we have an estimate of everybody, HIV-positive person in the survey who had a CD4 count of under 250, which is the Kenya guideline for ART treatment. And in Kenya, we find that the model actually matches pretty well with that survey-based estimate of need. And we're hoping that other countries will be able to do the same things. So we will be able to see how well these assumptions and methods actually match national needs. Same thing in PMTCT. The statistics are getting better, but in a country like Botswana, which has now 90% coverage of PMTCT, we can actually look at their figures on numbers of HIV-positive women coming through the PMTC system, and they're also doing dry blood spot to actually estimate the outcomes, so we can compare what Spectrum is doing with what Botswana is finding in its program. And again, it'd be nice if we could do that in more countries. And then finally, in response to one of the last questions, the same thing for orphans and vulnerable children. We can make these demographically based estimates, but we know that that's not the same as vulnerable children, as children really in need of support. And how can we modify these demographic estimates of orphans and turn them into the more programmatically useful estimate of children in need of some kind of support?
Yes, Eleanor?
I want to comment on your first question in relation to additional research. What we find in countries with generalized epidemics is that we generally have good trend data from antenatal clinic surveillance. And now we also have many countries with national population-based surveys from which we learn quite a lot. But we still find that in many countries with concentrated epidemics or low-level epidemics that we have very limited data on high-risk populations, particularly in relation to population sizes and prevalence, and it would be good to get more data on that.
My cries for new research have two suggestions. One, we need some research on better age and sex-specific models of infection to supersede the EPP package that we're using as a first step. because it's time that we were able to take advantage of the nationally representative surveys of HIV infection that gives us prevalence broken down by age and sex. And increasingly in countries that are doing two of these surveys, we have some trends in these data, and we need to be able to incorporate these directly into our estimates of epidemic spread. And my second suggestion for research would be on ART need. I can't remember now who showed a slide that said that the gap between people who actually know their HIV status but have not yet even been assessed for ART and not in the care system is negligible. This is certainly not what we're finding in Tanzania, at least, and I don't think that Tanzania is the only country where we have this problem. I think that referral systems are failing all over the place as VCT is rolled out much faster than access to ART and the encouragement to go and go to clinics rather than traditional healers, for example, and that more evidence is needed on the gaps between knowledge of HIV status and actually taking advantage of ART therapy.
Yeah, Eve?
I cannot more than agree with what you have said. We lack data about among people who are in need, who is informed and who is not informed about status. This data coming from Kenya that I have shown in one of the slides are coming since just last week. You know, it's a very, very new data. It's the first time that a population survey on AIDS has included not only testing and counseling, but also CD4 for people who have been informed about the on their status during the survey. It's based on a limited number of people. We can think that there are some methodological problems. This needs to be discussed, but I think it's the first time that we have from a country something that give some information. And I definitely agree with you. We need to have more data. We need to be able to assess more consistently what is the quality of this data and to find ways from different other countries to identify among people in need who is informed on their status and who is not informed about their status, because it means that there are, in any case, two different programmatic areas to strengthen, and this information will be extremely useful for countries who would like to really develop a scaling up process to know where they need to make the efforts.
Okay, my final comment will be, actually we have better methods for estimates. Estimates, simple, are estimates. It's our idea about the reality. Because the principal trouble that I saw is the quality of the data. The quality of the data is the key for better estimation. Many countries had not good data, and the country has not good data, not good estimation.
I would like to close the session thanking the speakers for the wonderful presentation, who has given us a peek to what is inside and the thinking behind the estimates. I also would like to think these presentations also bring attention that this is a work in progress. And as we get more data from the countries, quality data, more information, these processes will improve and we will have a better knowledge of the epidemic. And this, I think the last message to take home is that we need the countries to keep on working, providing quality data, not only on biological data, but also behavioral, so that we can improve this process and eventually know what is really happening with the epidemic and the trends. With further ado, I would like also to thank the audience for being here. The meeting is finished, and now go and enjoy Mexico City and its food. Thank you.